Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're continuing our study in Isaiah. Today we're going to be in chapters 46 and 47. They kind of deal with God's reaction and comments to Babylon. I thought it was very interesting. One of my favorite commentators is Leupold, and he mentioned, and I thought it was so just a wonderful insight, that Babylon, the king of Babylon, is dealt with in Isaiah 14. That the gods of Babylon are dealt with in Isaiah 46, and that Babylon as an entity, kind of the queen of the kingdoms, is dealt with in 47. And I think that's real true. Now, exactly why the order of the book of Isaiah, I don't think any of us know, but God does deal with Babylon. And of course, Isaiah lived 150 years plus before this all came about. Since I believe in predictive prophecy, as I mentioned to you last week, when Cyrus is mentioned by name in chapter 44:28 and 45:1, and he's certainly alluded to here about that he's going to call someone the bird of prey from the east. And of course, again, that's a reference to him. So let's look, if we could, at chapter 46:1. Baal has bowed down, Nebo stoops over. Now, the word Baal is an equivalent to the Canaanite word B-A-A-L, Baal. And they're both words for Lord. And this is one of the chief deities of the Babylonian pantheon. It's really another name for Marduk. Now, originally it was Enlil, E-N-L-I-L, of Nippur, who was the chief god. But it kind of changed some. The Babylon kind of has it, the pantheon has its own kind of development. And Marduk is the chief god. Now, Nebo is the god of learning, the god of writing. Some say, therefore, kind of equivalent to Mercury. We're not sure about that. But these are the two chief gods of Babylon in that day. Notice how they're bowed down. And in verse 2, they're stooped over. Now, I think this is a play on chapter 45, verse 23, where God says, "Every knee shall bow to me," Yahweh says, picked up in Ephesians 2:10 to speak of Jesus. But in context, here it's Yahweh, and here even the chief deities of Babylon are bowing down. Now, we've got to go back and understand, why would that be a significant thing? I want you to remember, in the ancient world, that the deity was caught up in the national life of the people. And when a people were defeated, it was considered their gods were defeated. Now, God had allowed himself to be humiliated by the Assyrian exile, and later the Babylonian exile, because it looked like the gods of Assyria and the gods of Babylon were stronger than the God of Israel. And what God is saying is, I did that for a purpose. And we're going to see that later on in this particular passage, where God says, I allowed that to happen. Matter of fact, I believe it's over here in... see if I can find that quickly. Well, it's in chapter 47, and I'll find it when I get there. Now, notice where it says, their images are consigned to the beast and to cattle. Now, it's the idea of these animals carrying these idols. Now, one or two things is possible. We know that these gods were related to certain cities. And many of these cities, like the city of Babylon, had several major temples. And in some annual festivals, these gods were carried from one temple to another in parades. Maybe there's an allusion to that here. Some say, no, it's in light of the Persian invasion, and these gods are being transported away to try to protect them from being captured. We know that, by the way, the god Nebo, or Nebu, you can see it in Nebuchadnezzar and Nebopalazar, that kind of thing, was about 18 feet tall in solid gold. So boy, it takes several animals to carry that one. A load for the weary beast. They stooped over. They have bowed down together. They could not rescue the burden. They have gone themselves into captivity. There are several places in the Old Testament where these different gods of the kingdoms, the god Milcom and all these other gods, have gone into captivity with their people. And that's the idea here. Now, there's a real play on verses 3 and 4. It's a play on the word carry. Number one, we talk about a woman carrying a baby. And there's going to be the allusion here to, I carried you in the wilderness, meaning when I formed you as a nation, was like a mother giving birth to a child. But then also about God carrying them, not only as children, but all the way through their normal human life. Even the old men God carries. And this is the ideal of God carrying them as these idols were carried or borne by something. So instead of these idols being carried away, Yahweh's the God who is not an idol. He's not forced to be carried around by someone. He is the God who acts, and He carries His people. It's a real play on this. Now, listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. You have been born my bee from birth, and I have carried you from the womb. You might want to see two beautiful passages. I think Deuteronomy 1:31 is so beautiful, and Isaiah 63:9, plus many others, are this same allusion. Now, this idea about this being children, that the people of God are the children of God, you might want to think of Hosea 11:1. But here's some other ones in Isaiah. Isaiah 44, verses 2 and 24 is a beautiful picture of that. Now, look at verse 4. Even to your old age, I shall be the same. Now, this deal, I shall be the same. That's a kind of a play on who God is. He's the ever-living God. He's the same yesterday and today and forever, is the New Testament way to put that. I never change. And even to your graying years, I shall bear you. I think of that poem that I read a lot of times in Christian art about we walked together along the seashore and there was two footprints and things got really tough and times were hard and there's only one set of footprints. And the poem writer asked God, "Where were you?" And God says, "My child, I was carrying you during that time of difficulty." And here's the biblical lock-in for that poem, if you please. Right here, God saying, "I carried you. I bore you." Now, some wonder, does this mean the life of an individual or does this mean the life of a nation? Of course it does. And here again is that beautiful ambiguity between the individual that trusts in Yahweh and the corporate sense of all the people of God. They both go together here. I have done it. I shall carry you, and I shall bear you, and I shall deliver you. And there's that continuing play there on carry. Now in verse 5 through 7 is an obvious discussion of the folly of idolatry. And there is some very poignant passages in the Bible about the ridiculousness of men taking a tree, cutting it, molding it into an idol, overlaying with gold, then taking the other half of the tree and cooking his evening meal on, and then bowing down to the idol that is the work of his own hands. You might want to see Isaiah 40, verses 18 through 20, very poignant, and Isaiah 44, 9 through 20, also very revealing about the folly of idolatry. To whom would you liken me, or make me equal and compare me? Now here is God saying, I'm unique. I'm not like an idol. I'm different. And there's so many beautiful passages. We looked at many of them last week where God says, there is no one beside me. Who will you compare me? You might want to see chapter 43, verse 11, chapter 44, verses 6 and 8, and chapter 45, 6, for just a kind of a contextual look at that tremendous concept. I think it goes back to monotheism. God says, I am the only God. And it's very strong through here. There's a play again in verse 7 on, they lift it up upon their shoulders and carry it. And that's what we've been looking at in verses 1 through 4 is this play on the word carry. And that continues some in this passage. Now, in verse 8, it says, remember this and recall it to mind. It's very common in the biblical literature to ask man to remember and ask God to forget. Because what we do, we ask God to forget our sin and ask man to remember the responsibility of the covenant. And here we have that right here. Now, in 8b it says, you transgressors. Now, who is this talking about? Well, it seems to refer to Israel. If we look back at the last chapter, the last section we did, chapter 45, verses 9 through 11, there was a group of Israelites who said it's unfair for God to use Cyrus. Well, these same kind of doubters are saying, well, God's just not doing it the way we would do it. And somehow these doubters in Israel are still involved. And God's saying, some translate, you rebels. It's the same group, I think, that are mentioned in verse 12, where they're called, listen to me, you stubborn-minded. And I think it's referring to the Jews, a people among the scattered people of Israel who are just not believing that God's going to do it and how God's going to do it. Remember the former things long past, for I am God, and there is no other. I am Elohim, and there is no one like me. It's continuing emphasis on the uniqueness, the sui generis of God. There are no other gods. Now, in the Old Testament, there are certainly other little g gods. And this, of course, is the word Elohim used in a different sense. It's sometimes used of the angelic beings. It's sometimes used of human judges. I think there are other spiritual beings, but they're not gods. Now, notice where it says, declare the end from the beginning and the ancient times from that which I have done. Now, here is an example of the uniqueness of God. He's going to predict the future. That has been the argument through this whole section of Isaiah. Isaiah says, look, I'm going to prove to you that I am God. I'm going to call Cyrus 150 years before he even comes on the scene. I'm going to condemn Babylon before they even become a world power. I'm going to show you that I am the controller of history, that I know what's happening. It's not to remove human freedom, but it's to say, I know I am the only true God, and because I tell you plainly before it happens, believe in me. I think it's God's way to bring the whole world to know him, as we saw back in chapter 45:6, a very important passage. Now, in verse the latter part of 10 and 11, listen to this, listen clearly now, saying, my purpose will be established. That's Yahweh speaking. Look at the next line. I will accomplish my good pleasure. Look at the last two lines of verse 11. Truly I have spoken. Truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it. I will surely do it. Now, friends, this is God saying, I'm in control. I'm going to show you. I want you to trust me. I want you to know that I know what's happening. You might want to see Isaiah 14, verses 24 and 26. You might want to see chapter 25, verse 1. God has a plan. God has a decree. History is what we call teleological. It's a Greek word, telos, meaning it's moving to a fulfillment. It does have some cyclical patterns, but history is on a linear a line. It is moving toward a climax. There is coming a time when God is going to step back into history. And remember what we talked about last time. The crisis of Isaiah's day, the crisis of Judah in the Babylonian captivity and the release under Cyrus' decree in 538 is telescoped together with the end time, the eschaton, the future. And that time is kind of pulled together, and that's what we see in these prophecies. Now, notice where it says in verse 11, the first part, the calling of a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country. And, of course, that's Cyrus. And you ought to see chapter 44:24 through chapter 45:25. It discusses specifically what Cyrus is going to do and why. Now, verses 11 and 12, again, is this unbelieving Israel. This is a very important Old Testament passage, particularly if you're Pauline in your theology and you believe in a forensic declaration of righteousness, not connected with our works or worth, but with the plan and purpose and particularly the mercy of God. These two verses are very important. Listen to me, you stubborn-minded. We're talking to a group of Jews who were not real faithful. Matter of fact, the second line says, who are far from my righteousness. These are not perfect people. These are doubting people. But they are the people of God. And so God says, I bring near my righteousness. Now, it's true the word righteousness and the word salvation or physical deliverance are always seem to be paralleled in the Old Testament prophecies. There's a sense in God coming to deliver them is parallel to his righteousness. Now, notice what it says. It is not far off, and my salvation will not delay, and I will grant, this is the word give, salvation in Zion and my glory in Israel. Now, God's actions are not based on a perfect godly people. It is not based on the merit of the Jews. Matter of fact, it is grace amidst their unbelief here. And so here we see clearly that it's an act of God's grace, not an act of human merit that causes God to act. I think it is not true that the New Testament is grace and the Old Testament is law. It was grace that called Abraham. It was grace that brought the people out of Exodus. It is grace that will bring Cyrus, not the merit of the Jewish people. God's going to save the Jewish people because he wants to use them to save the world. God's purpose is the salvation of all men, and he's using Israel to do that. And notice, he grants them salvation in the midst of their stubborn-mindedness. Now, folks, this is pretty close to justification by faith. And to see its Old Testament background, you ought to see Romans chapter 4 and Paul's presentation of the life of Abraham and David, and this would be just another one in the life of Israel. Now, notice again, it's an individual sense here, but it's a corporate context. Now, chapter 47. Come down and sit in the dust. Now, here we're personifying. We've been talking about the gods of Babylon in 46. Now we're going to personify the nation of Babylon as a young woman. It's somewhat similar to Babylon personified in the book of the Revelation, chapter 18, as the great whore. Now, Babylon has taken on the connotation, the Bible, of this idea of human government functioning apart from God. It's almost like atheistic humanism brought to an organizational level or administrative level. It's a human society meeting all their needs in their own resources. It's man measuring everything by himself. So here is this world power who has not even come to rise on the scene yet. Assyria is still in control, but the prophet sees it in the future. This whole section is a taunt song or a lament. It's a poetic structure to make fun of, like a funeral dirge. Come sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Now, this virgin daughter, that's what Jerusalem's often called. It's a way of speaking of security. Someone who is a virgin has not been sexually exploited. They have a freedom and a security for whatever reason. And so here Babylon is called a virgin daughter, but now she must leave the throne and come sit in the dust. A sign of mourning, a sign of dethronement, all of those things. Sit on the ground without a throne, sign of shame, O daughter of the Chaldeans. Now, the Chaldeans is pretty much a synonym for Babylon. It's the original home of the Babylonian Empire. It was the original language. So I think that's the idea here. For you shall no longer be tender and delicate. Now, tender and delicate is a word that's used in Deuteronomy 28:56 to describe luxurious, extravagant living. And now she's not going to have that. It's the idea of someone peeling your grapes for you before you eat them, all that kind of stuff. And so she's going to be taken off her throne and set in the dust. She's not going to be tender and delicate. Look at the rest of the things going to happen to her. Verse 2, take the millstones and grind meal. Instead of being the princess, now she's a common slave. The menial task of grinding grain in the ancient world was always done by slaves. So here she is doing hard labor. Look at this, remove your veil. She's no longer a fancy lady of the court. She has to take her veil off and her train off to do manual work. Strip off your skirt. Now, there's two possibilities here. It could mean the idea of shaming someone who's been a prostitute, and you might want to see that in Isaiah 20, verse 4, where that's so specifically mentioned. In verse 3 here is another allusion to that. But some have said it means to tuck in your skirt, like we would say gird up your loins in a New Testament sense, to do manual labor. That may be it here. Uncover the leg and cross the river. She's not a fancy lady. She doesn't get a ride across the river. She doesn't have a carriage that people carry. She has to pull up her skirt so it won't get wet and walk across the river. And it's, of course, a slave idea here. Now, in verse 3, it says, your nakedness will be uncovered. And here, I'm not sure if it's the judgment of a prostitute or just the simple idea of a slave. We seem to learn from Egyptian documents and pictures, wall paintings, that the slave women were dressed very scantily. Their breasts show. They were sexually exploited. They didn't have the beautiful dresses and hairdo of the fancy women. And that's something of this play from the princess to the slave. Now, Babylon is called the queen in verse 5 and 7. Well, she's not the queen anymore. She's the servant. And boy, what a fall it has been. And that's the play throughout here. Now, in the latter part of verse 3, it says, and will not spare a man. That's very difficult. The etymology of the words here seem to imply that no one can intercede on their behalf. No one's going to pray for Babylon. She has cruelly hurt the world, and the world's not going to pray for her. And the other idea that's also caught up in this word may be there is nobody to stand in God's way to accomplish his purpose with Babylon. No one can stop God, and no one can pray for Babylon. And it's this dual idea of which I'm not really sure. Verse 4 is kind of an ejaculatory clause. It does mess up the poetry, a meter, but it's almost like the prophet burst into praise here of the God of Israel who's going to do this. He uses several names for God. The first one in verse 4 is our Redeemer, our Goel. It's the word to buy somebody back from slavery. The Jews were made slaves, but God redeemed them. Now Babylon is a slave. It's the idea of a near kin who has money purchasing us back as a prisoner of war or purchasing us out of slavery. The Lord of Hosts. Now here, this is another wonderful title. It's used quite often of God in the post-exilic period. It was a Persian title for their gods. Maybe that's a play on Cyrus and his gods here. The word host is usually a military word. The God of the armies of heaven. That fits in this military passage. But it's also a God of the angelic world. Now, in Isaiah 24, 21 and 22, the Lord of hosts refers to the angelic beings, the gods of the nations, all of that, that kind of oppose Yahweh sometimes. But also, it is used several times for the astral deities of Babylon, Isaiah 40, 26. Now, which it is, I'm not sure, but God's in control. He's in control of the stars, and well, that Isaiah 40, 26 is a beautiful passage. He calls them by name, and they line up for muster. These stars don't control human destiny. These astral deities aren't in control of the world. And so whether it's the angelic realm or these astral deities also representing angels or gods, God's is the Lord of hosts. And then finally, the Holy One of Israel, this characteristic title for the covenant God of Israel, this ethical God that chose Israel to choose a world. And here these three names just burst in the poem. Sit silently and go into darkness. Now, what is this? Well, I think it's a sense of you've been judged. Now, just in quietness and in the corner of the room, sit there and take your judgment in kind of an oblique way. Just be in obscurity over there and be quiet. That's what it was. And what a change that was from Babylon, who was used to being in control. Notice it calls her the queen of the kingdom. She's not a queen anymore. She's a handservant. Verse 6, I was angry with my people. I profaned my inheritance. Now, here is the verse I was looking for earlier. Why did God do this to his people? It wasn't because that God was less powerful than the gods of Assyria or the gods of Babylon. No, it wasn't those gods overcame Yahweh. It's that Yahweh, in his ethical nature, chose to judge his people for their sins by using foreign empires. He used Assyria, Isaiah 10:5. He used Babylon right here to judge his people. But look what these people did. They went too far. They went beyond what God called for and gave them into your hand, but you did not show mercy to them. On the aged, you made their yoke heavy. And what God's saying is, now, I used you to judge my people, but you went too far, and now I'm going to judge you. And so here is God, the ethical God of the universe, judging those that he used to judge his people. Now, the idea of the problem of the aged, it's very common. These empires like Assyria and Babylon, who call sieges, they would kill the children, they would kill the old people as a way to discourage and cut the generation off. And that's so true. Now, when it says here in verse 7, and you said, I shall be queen forever. And down in the middle part of verse 8 where it says, I am and there is none beside me. You kind of see the pride of Babylon, who thought she was so great and so powerful that nobody could ever put her off the throne. And God says, I beg your pardon, I'm in control here. And because you have hurt my people and said you're going to be queen forever, and because you've said there is no one beside me, claiming deity for the nation itself, using the title for God, God says, I'm going to judge you. As God judged Moab, who thought they were so inaccessible and so prideful, God judged them. God judges every nation that thinks they're something, friends. God's the one that is in control of this world, not these imperialistic nations. Now, notice if you would, and now then, verse 8, hear this, you sensual one. Now, what is the sensual one talking about? Well, some think it refers to the latter part of verse 10. I think maybe it refers to the idea we learned from Herodotus and others that there was almost a drunken orgy going on the night that Cyrus's general took over the city of Babylon, Daniel chapter 5. They were so sure that no one could take this city, and yet they diverted the water from under the walls. The troops got in the city, and because Belshazzar and his father had gone to a special god, the god of Zen, the moon goddess, the rest of the city was glad that Cyrus came because it let them go back to their traditional gods, Baal, Nebo, Marduk. Now, notice where it mentions here then. You're going to be a widow. You're going to have all your children gone. And, of course, that's the idea of this fallen empire. But these are two things that shall come to you suddenly in one day. Now, here's where Daniel 5 certainly comes in. They fail in one night. Now, beginning in verse 9 and running for several verses is this mention about Babylon, so known for her sorceries and chants and wise men and astrology and incantations, and God's kind of mocking them. Where are your astrologers? Where are your wise men? Where are your diviners? Let them deliver you. Let them save you. Where are they? Well, they're nothing. There's nothing to this. It's all a sham. And the part that wasn't sham, that part which they've been demonic, God is so much powerful than that. In spite of all your sorceries, in spite of your great power of your spells, your occult practices, you may want to see Deuteronomy 8, 9 and following, where these are condemned to the people of God. Now, verse 10, and you felt secure in your wickedness. Now, the word here, wickedness, Dead Sea Scrolls changes the word wickedness by changing a D to an R and makes it the word knowledge. And I think knowledge does fit this as a play on these sorceries, but either one fits. And you say, well, no one will see me. They knew they were wicked. They were trying to hide their sin. You might want to see Isaiah 29:15 for a very powerful word there. Notice verse 11. Will you not know how to charm away? The word means bribe. You can't bribe these foreign gods away. Look at verse 11 about D. You cannot atone. This is the word cover. Look at verse 12. Your spells and your sorceries. And look at the last of verse 12. Perhaps you are causing trembling. Now, my favorite commentator, Lupo, adds the word to me. With God saying, come on, shoot your best shot and see if you can make me afraid. Call on all your demons and all your spells and all your sorcerers and all your gods and see if you can make me afraid. And I think that fits so well. In this book I use quite often called The Bible in 26 Translation, listen to some of these translations. This is from the Moffat Bible. Perhaps you'll be able to scare off your foes. Here's the NEV, the New English Bible. Maybe you will yet inspire awe. And here's the Jerusalem Bible. Do you think that you will make anyone nervous by all your spells? And so you see how that is used. Now, notice here in verse 13, again, all these different kind of charmers, astrologers and stargazers and those who predict by the moon. They're just like stubble. They're like shafts that'll be burned. In verse 14, we mention this judgment fire of God that's going to destroy all of the wickedness and evil and false religion of Babylon. It's a play on the word fire. As you know, fire is a symbol of God's judgment. It's used to destroy nations. But it also can be, in its domestic sense, can be to cook our food and heat our homes. God says, this is not a friendly fire, folks. This is a fire of judgment that will destroy all of the city and culture of Babylon. Now, we know that Babylon was not destroyed completely under Cyrus, but was later destroyed under Xerxes, the city, and all the religious aspects. So it's not that it's going to happen, this complete destruction, exactly when Cyrus takes over, but it will happen in the course of years. And Babylon becomes a biblical metaphor for man trying to do his own thing, and one day that's going to be totally destroyed as the Holy One of Israel returns. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I hope to see you same time, same place next week. God bless you.